Cutting the Curd is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country? For more information, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd, broadcasting live on the Heritage Radio Network. This is your host, Greg Blaze. On last week's show, I spoke with Jason Hines, one of the co-founders of the Essex Street Cheese Company, about Comté, arguably one of the best cheeses in the world. One of my takeaways from my conversation with Jason is the way in which cheese, specifically Comté, is so much more than just cheese. Cheese can transport us through time and place because of its inherent connection to the land and the animals and the people who make it. Made in a similar style to Comté, Upland's Pleasant Ridge Reserve is also arguably one of the best cheeses in the world, certainly one of the best in the United States. It's been a staple in the counters I've run over the years because of its consistent high quality and true taste of place. With that in mind, on today's show, we have the lead cheesemaker and proprietor of Upland's Cheese, Andy Hatch. How are you doing, Andy?
Great, Greg. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So, Andy, this has been a big year for you, man. And when you were on Cutting the Curd previously, you spoke a little bit about your seasonal grass-based dairy system. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the changes over at Upland's this year.
Well, if you're referring to the change in ownership.
Yeah, I sure are. I sure am.
Yeah, changing of the seasons or of the guard. This is something that's been in the works for a long time. I started here in 2007 as an apprentice under Mike, and then gradually just took on more and more responsibility, you know, became the head cheesemaker and then started running the caves and talking to customers. So it was something we'd been talking about for years and years, but it was finally in February that we signed the paperwork. And so I, my wife and I bought the farm with another couple, Scott and Liana Marika. So we're following really in the same pattern that Mike and Dan Patnaud established, where yeah. There are two families running the farm. One runs the cow end and the other the cheese end. So we basically just stepped right into their shoes. Scott, running the cows now, had been here for years too. So it was a big deal in one sense, but in another sense, nothing has changed. You know, day to day, it is running the same with the same people as it has for years.
What are your new challenges? I mean, as the owner, I mean, you say nothing's changed, but it's literally it's got to be something a little bit different.
Everything's changed. Yeah, I manage a little bit more stress. You know, I always watched the numbers and had to, but I sweat them a little more now. You know, I suppose running a cheese counter, you know, you've got to manage your inventory, control your costs, look at your sales. But you know, when it's you writing the checks, there's another layer of pressure.
Sure, but yeah, I imagine. Yeah. So it was easier being the cheese maker.
I think back about those days, and all I had to do was make cheese. It'd be done at like 3 in the afternoon, go get on the motorcycle or whatever, go fishing. I mean, now I finished making cheese. I just finished.
Uh-huh.
And now I get to my desk, and now, you know, I have a whole other day's work, basically, at the desk. But it's what I wanted, and it hasn't been disappointing at all. But it's a challenge. I think, you know, a lot of people who are good at something, there's an irony in as they rise through their craft, you get to the point where you're managing people doing the work that you were once good at.
Yeah, it's tough to take your hands out of it, I would imagine, just because.
So I don't imagine I'll ever get totally to that stage. I mean, right now I'm at my desk. I'm probably 8 feet from the vat.
Yeah, you know, that's great.
So, you know, we're ideally at a sweet spot here in terms of size, I think, where I can still make cheese, you know, handle sales and customers and employees. And, you know, I think if we got a magnitude bigger, a lot of that would change. I might have to start choosing one role or the other. But for now, when one of the things that was really appealing to me about this operation was that I could still have a hand in every part of it.
No, and you certainly, I mean, I understand what you mean. I mean, I do manage. I don't write the checks. I feel like I do sometimes.
Your body's writing the checks.
Yeah, absolutely. In more ways than one, actually. But I understand it's not that you have to let go, but it's just, it is a little bit different. There's that layer that you're used to having, or that I'm used to having, you know, that you can put your back up against. But, I mean, that layer is you now. I mean, that must be a little bit different for you. But I mean, the cheese is as great as ever. So, you know.
Well, thanks. it's something, you know, I inherited here sort of a culture of just of curiosity and tinkering, and you know, and Mike was that way. Both he and I have brains that we can be totally consumed by improving the one thing. You know, people ask me, you know, do you get bored making just one thing?
That's hard to do.
I just think, well, if you know, you're not looking at it closely enough. If, you know, if your attention's wandering, there's so much to pay attention to. And, you know, seasonal raw milk pasture-based cheese is always going to be variable, and that's the beauty of it.
Anytime you're dealing with one product, I mean, I remember when I worked for Essex and I sold the Comté, it's difficult. I mean, it's easier sometimes to have a bunch of things to turn to, you know, and you have to maintain consistency, you know, that cheese has to taste the same all the time, you know, for people not to, and it has to be at a very high level, which it obviously is, you know. I mean, that's a tough thing to do.
Yeah, there's nowhere to hide. I mean, you can't, well, have you seen our, you know, no, it's just, you know, you and your one cheese.
Well, you're two cheeses, right? I mean, you're
two
still going to make...
Yeah, we still kind of talk about it, yeah, like it's not in the room. But we do make a little bit of Rush Creek every year.
Just a little bit, right?
Yeah.
You're going to continue to do that, I hope. I mean, I beg you.
As long as we're allowed to, you bet.
Yeah, that's true. You know, and I was talking before in the intro how I had spoken to Jason last week about Comté, and I wanted to get your opinion on that. You know, that cheese definitely is the evidence of the terroir that it comes from, you know, given the care and, like, the animal's diet and, you know, the altitude, the pasturage, and it's just how it affects the culture around it. I believe that your cheese is the same, you know? I mean, do you feel that it's absolutely a representation of the land that it comes from?
It is, and that's sort of the whole goal behind how we run our whole farm. You know, we have a closed herd of cows. We don't buy in outside cows. So the same families of cows we've been breeding for decades, you know, they just eat our own pasture, and we just use that milk to make our cheese. So everything we're doing, not pasteurizing the milk, ripening here on the farm, everything we're doing is to make as direct a connection as possible between our soil and climate and what the customer tastes. And Comté is, in my mind, the benchmark for that.
For Alpine cheese.
Especially in terms of how well it's organized on a larger scale, which gets away from what we're doing as one farm. But they've systematically, you know, managed to capture the flavor of that landscape. And, I mean, that's a beautiful thing to taste, but and then also to behold the economic impact it's had. You know, I haven't had a chance to listen to what Jason's said about it, but, I mean, what Comté represents as a, you know, an economic force and a cultural force over there is, to me, the benchmark for what cheese can do for a rural community. It's a beautiful thing. And, you know, the model here originally with Mike was Beaufort. And,
right.
And that, you know, single herd of cows, summer milk only.
Yeah.
I tend to look more at Comté, especially when it comes to affinage and selection and how detail-oriented they are and understanding their cheese. Yeah, you know, people ask me all the time, you come out with a new cheese. Like, do you say that to the Comté guys?
Yeah, exactly. when you say that you use them as a model, that's a good. So you want to be able to get people to understand the difference between cheeses made in the fall and the spring and the summer. Is that, you know?
I want to understand. I mean, to open
right.
All of that variability up to your customers gets complicated. And there are certain customers that want to have a dialogue like that. A guy like you buying cheese, you'll say, yeah, give me something 9-10 months. You know what you're looking for. What impresses me so much about some of the Comté Affineurs, and I've visited the one Jason works with Jason, Marcel Petit,
yeah.
You know, over 100,000 wheels.
It's crazy down there.
Yeah, five guys spending all their days tasting and selecting just of the level of attention they pay to you know, variability of flavor and linking the right cheese with the right customer. That, you know, is my goal. I spend the whole summer, you know, bent over the vat, pumping
right.
it out, making cheese. And in the winter, that's when I try to think like, you know, Saint-Antoine.
Sure.
You know, there in the cave, you're sorting through all these batches of cheese. For us, it's about 150.
I was going to say, how many wheels?
Yeah,
are
10,000.
10,000 wheels.
You know, 150 days. It's like going through a library of time, you know, June 2nd.
Completely.
Or June 4th. You're going through the history of the season, and you're trying to figure out, you know, what is the sweet spot for that cheese? When is it ready, and who should it go to?
What do you feel is the best? What's the optimal age for Pleasant Ridge Reserve?
Well, I hate to give a qualified answer when you want like a number, but yeah, it depends what you're gonna do with it. Like, you know, fondue, melting it,
right.
Younger, 7-8 months.
Right.
You know, something big after dinner. You know, 15 months.
15.
15, 16. But for me, most often, what I want, I mean, I want to actually tuck into a, you know, 6 ounces of cheese. A lot of cheese would be like 13.
13
yeah,
months.
10, yeah, 10, 12, 13 months. Depends, you know, on the batch, but...
No, and I understand. I mean, obviously, you know, all your cheeses are a tiny bit different, which, I mean, is the beauty of it for you, especially, I'm sure, when you're sorting them all out there in the winter, you know, you're ironing them and turning them.
Yeah.
That's good. I mean, that's...
It's like having, different children.
Only 150.
Of course they're different, yeah.
No
out
deal.
Here in Wisconsin, we like to take
No, that's I mean, I love Alpine cheeses, and I've been a big supporter of your cheese from the days when Mike brought some to me, and way back in like a brown sack, you know, and like came.
Yeah, Mike refers to you as one of his first ever customers.
he was. I'll never forget that. For myself, Pleasant Ridge Reserve. You know, as I've gotten to know you, it's been fantastic. That's always been one of my, I use this word sparingly, like a touchstone of cheese in America. You know, and I mean, for you, you must be so happy and so proud to be able to continue that and like in a seamless transition. You know, I mean,
it was very lucky for all of us, the timing, and it's awfully tempting. You know, just as an American, you want to go do something new. And, you know, there's been so many new exciting cheeses the last 10 years that the appeal of trying to go do my own new thing was there.
The pull was there?
Yeah, but there was nobody else here who was going to take it over. And so, you know, faced with the thought of Pleasant Ridge going extinct.
Oh, my God, no. That would not be good.
So no, we were really lucky with the timing, and it took Mike's vision and generosity. You see a lot of farm transitions struggle because you know dad won't let go, or
there's no one to give it to. There's no one there to give it to. When I talked to Lisa Hall in one of the first episodes I did, she was talking to me about how difficult it is. Just to have a subsistence farmer or an independent farm in the state of Wisconsin in general right now.
Yeah, yeah, and it's obviously an issue for farms. They've known that for a long time, but I think it's also going to be an issue for our industry. You know, you have some of these small to mid-sized cheese companies whose owner-operators are in their 60s, 70s,
right.
You know, what's their exit strategy? You know, you get, as you know, we're 100,000 pounds of cheese. You get this big, you know, guys like me can't afford to come in and buy it. So, you know, the people that can't afford are bigger dairy companies, bigger fish, you know, swallowing smaller fish. And you see that in the craft beer industry. I don't
know
enough about that to know what kind of consequences it has, but certainly the worry you have with American artisan cheese is a loss of diversity.
That's tough.
If you can't keep these independent operators independent, what are we going to lose?
We're going to lose everything. I mean, and to me, you know, as a purchaser of cheese, I mean, sometimes I look at it the other way, you know, and I talk to people since I took over doing the weekly shows, you know, and I've asked everybody, asked people in like the old school and new school series, you know, is there too much cheese sometimes? So sometimes, you know, when you're being brought things, you know, you think, oh, Jesus, there's so much cheese out there, you know?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
then
yeah.
When you look at it, like from your perspective, you like that, it's so tenuous a grip on that because it can all just go away really quickly, you know, due to those circumstances if you don't have a transition that's proper.
And I think they're seeing that in France now, you know.
They are, according to the people I've talked to, you know, like there's like this I don't know if it's a generational thing, but they're it's shrinking, like farmstead operations are shrinking, or so I've been told.
That's what I hear too. I think based on the opportunities in U.S. that don't exist in Europe for growth, you know, developing new products and feeding a market that wants, you know, new and innovative cheese, there's an appeal here for young cheesemakers to get into it. Of course, but financially it's difficult. The Cheese Reporter last week, I think, had a piece done out of Oregon State. They looked at the startup costs for an artisan cheese making operation in the U.S. And I think they thought to scale up to 60,000 pounds, which is, you know, not a big operation. They thought it was about $600,000 to $700,000.
That's not a lot.
What you'd need in cash. It's a lot. It's a lot of money. It's a capital intensive, and that's assuming you're.
No, I don't mean it's not a lot of. It's not a lot of money. I don't mean that's not a lot of output for the for the investment. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. I mean that's
right.
Yeah,
to make a return on that is going to be difficult. So I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I certainly don't see subsidies coming down the pipeline for small scale cheesemakers. But you know, I hope that as an industry, we just stay aware that you know, young people like me, it's not easy to get in the game. And
well, no.
In my case, I got really lucky, but we need to keep figuring out how to give young people opportunity and sure that the independent businesses that are so meaningful to artisan American cheese can stay, you know, independent and distinctive. And
well, you can say that you're lucky, and I mean, you were definitely fortuitous, and the opportunity was there for you. But you also took it and you ran with it, and that's
we're taking an enormous risk.
Yeah.
I mean, I signed my life away, you know.
You literally bought the farm. My God, man, it's like you're there. I mean, that I think is more well, to me, what I love about your operation, and despite all of those risks, you did that. You didn't change anything except for the better, you know? I mean, you look at it the same way, and I think it's important for our industry to have those people who are pillars, and like those cheeses that are pillars and that are always going to be there, you know? And that's something that you definitely provide. And I sure appreciate it. It's an easy sell for me, you know? And the cheese is great. So we're going to have to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with Andy Hatch from Uplands Dairy. Thanks a lot.
Hi, I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. This summer, Heritage Radio Network is turning 5 years old. Since our launch in 2009, we've continued to bring you food and culture content like no one else. And we need, absolutely need your help. HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a passionate, grassroots, action-oriented nonprofit organization. That means we depend on the support from listeners like you to keep us alive. If you love what you hear on Heritage Radio Network, visit our website and become a member today. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
The Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board are proud to underwrite Cutting the Curd on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Wisconsin cheeses have an illustrious heritage of more than 170 years of quality and craftsmanship. During this long and rich history, the art and science of cheesemaking have been captured in time-honored traditions that produce cheese varieties of unsurpassed excellence. Today, Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hi, I'm Reggie Watts, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
We're back on Cutting the Curd. On the phone, we have Andy Hatch of Uplands Cheese in Dodgeville, Wisconsin. During the Old School New School series I was doing a couple weeks ago, I asked each cheesemaker to tell me a little bit about what they envision to be the future of their cheeses and their cheesemaking operations. And we started to talk about the future of all cheesemaking operations in the United States right before the break. But I was wondering, Andy, since you made, you know, obviously a huge investment by purchasing Uplands, what do you see as the future of the farm in Pleasant Ridge in the long term? You want to expound on that?
Yeah, well, important question, and you know, you alluded to the risk and the debt somebody in my position has to take on to buy a farm, and so given that, you know, the plan for the next several years is survival,
right?
Pay back the bank. That's sort of the unromantic reality of it. In terms of the cheese making, like you said, we've not changed any of the principles, and I really can't see doing that. You know, we will make Rush Creek, like I said, as long as we can. But we are a Pleasant Ridge farm. Everything we do here, from the breeding of the cows, managing the pastures, is all geared around that grazing season and producing, you know, the most beautiful milk we can for that cheese. There are, you know, fantasies that knock around my head about growth, and I think that's as much just...
What kind of fantasies are you having, man?
Well, Greg, they involve autumn milk.
Really?
Yeah, we still sell some of this milk when we're done making Pleasant Ridge. We dry our cows up by about Christmas, so November, December, quite a bit of milk. Well, all of it really leaves the farm, and we'll probably never use all that milk for Rush Creek. It's just too labor-intensive of a cheese.
Sure.
As far as growth goes, or the next stage of what we do here, that's sort of the low-hanging fruit. You know, you have some really beautiful, heavy, rich milk that late fall milk, leaving the farm, you know, going down the road to a local cheese factory. So I'm always, you know, kind of at the drawing board with ideas, and it's fun to be at that stage, but I always have a voice in the back of my head. It's probably Mike's voice, actually.
Yeah.
You know, don't complicate it.
Don't do it.
You know, and sometimes I feel like, yeah, it'd be, I'm married to Pleasant Ridge, and it'd be unfaithful. It was really interesting to see how much the second cheese complicated our lives.
Yeah, how much Rush Creek complicated your lives?
Yeah. You just, now I wake up in the morning, and if you think about Pleasant Ridge, you're falling asleep, you think about Pleasant Ridge, that
sure.
way for six months, and then, you know, you can exhale and relax. and all of a sudden you got something else to think about. It's like having a second child at home.
Right.
I was just running in circles.
I don't know, man.
I'm certainly in no rush to complicate things here, but the idea of a new cheese is fun, and there is milk there that we started playing with ideas. So that's one reason I came out to New York recently, tasted my way through some cheese counters, including yours. You guys have some incredible cheese that we just don't get out here.
Yeah, man. It's New York. I mean, it's just, I always have planes, trains, automobiles, boats are all, everything's moving towards me with cheese. I'm like, I don't even want to think about it right now. It makes me makes me nervous. It's so hot right now. And but I understand the need. Well, not the need. I understand what you're talking about making a new cheese. And you and I have spoken about that when we do.
Right.
I mean, I always love I love new stuff, and I collect cheese.
It's exciting.
It is. I mean, it is. And when you taste something new, like for the first time, you know, and it's really good, you're super pumped, you know. And for you, I would imagine if you made something, you know, that like just got you even more, you know, even more stoked. I mean, that would be a great way to grow for you. But I think also what I wanted to ask you is, and it's a weird question, but I'm asking you anyway. Like, it's almost like. Not like you would be so Mike had you know, and that's great. And I really love your path. I've been reading up on how you lived in that remote shack in Norway with no TV. Yeah. And like I want to ask you about that in a second. Who would make the cheese after you? I mean, would you want one of your little
When I'm 75 years old?
Yeah, I'll be long gone then, but I want to know. I want to know, you know, do you think about that ever?
Oh, I do a little bit, you know, especially having children now.
Right.
I have a one-year-old and a two-and-a-half-year-old. It's far too far away. But
I know. I know it is.
I do think about, you know, like we were talking about before with scale, you know.
Right.
There's this kind of American mantra, if you're not growing, you're dying. And, you know, I can feel that inside of me. You want to grow, you want to do new things, you want to get bigger. But I worry I'd get to the point where my son couldn't afford to buy it.
Right.
Or, you know, you're going to have to sell to a big company or an investment group, which isn't the end of the world. But
we got to pick the right one, obviously. I mean,
I think, you know, and once a company like that gets a hold of a farm like this, it's apt to change its principles. You know, I ended up not having to take on investors to buy this.
That's awesome.
I did the dance with quite a few of them.
Of course.
And they, you know, they all want to see that kind of hockey stick growth, a big growth in revenue, and then, you know, they get their payout, or they turn around and sell it again. And so, you know, a lot of them fed this kind of thinking of, oh, you got to do a third cheese, you got to do, you know, more Pleasant Ridge, let's bring in some outside milk. And so, you know, when you get to the scale and you have the financial obligations to investors or shareholders where, you know, you're constantly pushing for growth, I think you sort of change the principles of an operation like this. You know, our farm is really based on the harvest of grass from, you know, 300 acres over 6 months. There's a natural limit to that.
Sure.
And, the world of finance isn't really built to respect something like that always. So
I think it's interesting word, you know, your plan is survival initially, you know, and then that's the just I think the reality for all of us that do this work,
yeah,
you know, yeah. That mentality of you got to go, you got to grow all the time. I mean, I get that bug poisons me, and that's how you end up with like 300 types of cheese at your cheese counter, and then you got to sell all that stuff, and you freak out, but. I think that's a real honest look at it. And I think it's awesome that you didn't. Well, I mean, And you're a smart man. You made your choices. I'm sure your place will be in good hands. I just wanted to pick your brain about it for a minute.
Are you looking for a job, Greg? Or
always, man. Yeah. Always.
you've got a lucky job. I have a really good cheese making crew here. Some of whom are actually even younger than I am. So
is that legal?
The future looks really good here.
That's great, man. I'm sure it does. I want to ask you one more thing too. So while I've been doing these interviews, I realized that there's this crazy connection between where I've been finding that there's a lot of connection between cheese professionals and music. My friend Jason last week, and you should listen to that show because it's awesome. And he was a DJ in London, like a house DJ in London for a while, which is a crazy scene. But you're a musician too, man, right? You play the violin, you play the mandolin.
Yeah.
And are you still making music?
Yeah, we just got done in the studio, actually. Mixing and mastering will be the second album with this band.
That's great.
Yeah, string band music.
I love that.
It's a lot of fun.
Point Five is your band, right?
Yep, that's it.
That's killer. And you got a lot of instruments in your house, you said? So
piles of them.
Piles of them? That's awesome.
Yeah, that's my retirement plan.
Is to take Point Five on the road?
Yeah, I don't know. I've been there, done that.
Really?
Not for me anymore, but come out and play Italy.
We'd love that. That would be awesome. We'll set you up in the piazza. Lastly, do you think that there's a connection between music and artists in the cheese community?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think brains that are attracted to music can get attracted to sort of rhythmic production, like cheese making. I'm not just trying to like play on.
I don't think you are.
Rhythm. I really think there's rhythm and there's a cyclical nature to making cheese every day. You know, the rhythm of that is really similar to practicing and playing music. You know, especially if you're playing classical music or any music, a band goes on tour and plays more or less the same set, dozens of times on a tour. How do you make that meaningful again and again? I mean, you really have to, love that music.
Sure.
And the same thing making cheese over and over again. It's like practicing a piece of music. You've got to find meaning in repetition. You got to, fall in love with that.
You got to buy into the rudiments of it, right? I mean, the scales of cheese making are probably...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you internalize that rhythm and get locked into it and carried away with it. It's the same sort of zone.
That's great. Well, I think that's a good place for us to stop because it's on a great note. I want to say thanks so much, Andy. It's always good to talk to you. Keep making that great cheese, and hopefully we'll get your band to come out and play at Eataly. That would be fun.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for having me, Greg.
That's always a pleasure. Thank you guys for listening. This has been another episode of Cutting the Curd. We'll be back next week on Live on the Heritage Radio Network. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.